ABC Tomorrow. The Bachelor is entering its golden era with the premiere of The Golden Bachelor. For the first time in the Bachelor franchise history, 72-year-old Gary Turner is setting out to prove it's never too late to fall in love again. Millions are swooning over The Golden Bachelor. The LA Times raves the series is a love story years in the making. Glamour magazine exclaims there's no expiration date on romance. This is must-see TV. The Golden Bachelor premieres tomorrow on ABC and stream next day on Hulu.
Warning, the following message contains an app recommendation you won't be able to resist.
Girl, how do you keep getting all these things for free? Coffee, makeup, and now lunch?
You haven't heard of the Drop app? Drop is a free app that rewards you for shopping at places like Ulta, Adidas, and Sam's Club. I've already earned $100 this month.
Download the Drop app and get $5. Use invite code GETDROP222.
Nissan's electric vehicles run on a special electricity. Not the electricity that turns on light bulbs or runs through your outlets. I'm talking that spine-tingling goosebump feeling that electrifies your body and soul. It could be the simple win of leaving on time for your morning commute or scoring the largest deal of your career. Nissan is continuously evolving and changing the game through electric vehicle engineering. Because the electricity of their cars not only moves engines, it also moves the emotions of those who drive them. To learn more about Nissan's electric vehicle lineup, visit www.nissanusa.com.
Upgrade your listening with Bose Quiet Comfort Ultra headphones. Breakthrough Bose Immersive Audio makes everything sound more natural than ever. World-class noise cancellation gets quieter than any Bose headphone yet. And the high-fidelity audio is tailored to your ears only. So highs hit harder, bass drops deeper, and you feel every note of the track. This is leveled up listening. Bose Quiet Comfort Ultra headphones. Dive in deeper at Bose.com/iHeart.
For each person living with myasthenia gravis, or MG, their journey with this rare condition is unique. That's why Untold Stories, Life with Myasthenia Gravis, a new podcast from iHeartRadio in partnership with Argenix, is exploring the extraordinary challenges and personal triumphs of underserved communities living with MG. Host Martine Hackett will share these powerful perspectives from real people with MG, so their experiences can help inspire the MG community and educate others about this rare condition. Listen to find strength in community on the MG journey on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Our American Stories, and as you know, some of our favorite stories and some of your favorite stories on this show are redemption stories, comeback stories about people who turn their lives around, which brings us to our next story. It comes from the documentary The Father I Never Knew, a movie that tracks the lives of former gang members that were raised without a positive father figure, which you can find on Amazon Prime. The director, Don Albert, graciously gave us the interviews to tell these stories. And now we bring you the story of Carlos Colon.
I was born in Chicago, Illinois, in Humboldt Park. From the 70s on through the 90s, it was pretty drastic. Growing up with a single mom, the gangs was pretty bad in the neighborhood, and poverty was at its worst. I think about my upbringing, and it was a lot of empty lots, so there wasn't no playgrounds. It was just empty lots, where no buildings were and where they used to be. So a lot of times, we turned to the streets, and, you come from a dysfunctional home where you see drug abuse from different men in my mom's lives and domestic abuse. I turned to the streets. I spent most of my life in prison from juvenile on through my adulthood. Single mother, never knew my dad, poor, and my mom was in two abusive relationships, so that had its toll. I was missing the father's love, for his son, and not only that, but a complete family, something, you know, a father's supposed to be, you know, sense of security. He's supposed to be the one to provide, and we didn't have that in my house. So I never knew what it was like to grow up a man. I pretty much was playing the guessing game and going off of a lot of bad examples in my life ahead of me. And so the streets were my father. In my teen years, I joined a gang, you know, and I clung to that. And what attracted me to the gang was actually just the unity. We all had something in common. A lot of us were miserable. We had no fathers in our lives. And so it's like a pack of dogs, you know, we hung together and we clung together, and life spiraled real fast. We would steal a car in the city, a beat up car, go to O'Hare Airport and look for a nice car, something with rims and speakers and sound system. And we would try to bring it back to Chicago and sell it. So we were doing this for a while now, and we got caught. And when they caught us, it seemed like they were investigating. So there was like 6 or 7 cars that they charged us with, which, trust me, we did take. But I ended up going fighting the case out as best I can, and I ended up getting probation. The rules were too much for me. I couldn't handle it. They had house arrest, and I had to do all these crazy things just to stay out of jail, which I violated. So I eventually ended up going to juvenile detention center, which is like juvenile prison. And that's where I spent a lot of time in and out of until, you know, I got out at about, I think I was 17 when I got out. So from 15 to 17, I spent most of my time in and out of juvenile detention. And once I went into juvenile, I was being trained for when I got out to be worse. We were a small gang. So by being a small gang, we had more to prove than these big gangs. You know, it's not like, oh, you know, we were well established in Chicago. No, we were a small gang. We had one corner, and in that corner, it was only, if there were 50 of us, which some people might think 50 is a lot of people, but there's hundreds and thousands of gangs out here. There could be no war going on, because a lot of times we'll go into war and we'll fight with each other. I remember I would be driving with my buddies, and we would see someone's car, and we'd say, hey, that's so-and-so's car from this neighborhood, and it's someone we don't like. And we would already know, okay, his car's parked here. Tomorrow or tonight in the late night, we're going to burn his car. And we would burn cars, break windows, even to the point where sometimes we would go to other neighborhoods and jump out on people and jump them and act like we were a different gang just because, for the thrill of it, because we wanted to instill damage. And I would say even at 20, it got to the point where now, if we could catch you, but no one was around, and we had a gun on us, we would actually try to kill you. You know, we would see if we could get away with it, or at least shoot you or something, without you knowing it was us. That's how bad it was. You know, it just escalated from, you know, stealing cars in my life to knives, bats, guns, and murder eventually. And I remember getting into a shootout with somebody, getting away, telling a friend of mine about it. And after I spoke to him about it, shortly afterwards, they came back. I got shot. I got shot in the hand and in the leg, and I did about a month or two in the hospital recovering. And during that time, the war was still going on. Pretty much it started because I got shot. My buddy got killed. So that took its toll on me too. You know, he's a friend of mine who his dad passed away and got killed, so he grew up without a father. And so I was bringing him up into the gangs, and next thing you know, he's dead. So I felt that was my responsibility. And I wanted revenge, you know, for so much. It was like just a pot of so much boiling and brewing, and I wanted to get revenge. So I got out of the hospital, and you know, when I got shot because I ran out of bullets. So I didn't want that to happen no more. And I remember, saying, well, I'm gonna buy 2 guns, and I'll keep one on me, and when I'm walking with somebody, I let them hold the other one just to be safe. And as I was healing and recuperating, and you know, I couldn't run, I was still walking with a cane, I ran into one of the guys who was involved in my shooting. I shot him 5 times, and shortly afterwards, they pronounced him dead at the hospital, and the cops were looking for me. And it's funny because he was his only witness, but what happened was the cops actually grabbed one of the guys from my neighborhood, and instead of being a stand-up guy, he actually ratted me out. And so once I knew that the cops were looking for me, it was over with for me. I had to leave the neighborhood. Chicago wasn't an option no more. So I fled, and I ended up from, you know, to Ohio, to Florida, Puerto Rico, Ohio, back to Florida for about 11 months I was a fugitive. I was working at this furniture warehouse under a different name. I just made the union and everything, so I was meeting a lot of people, the big wigs from the warehouse, corporate. And I remember my supervisor walking up to me with this man, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm gonna meet another supervisor. And when I shook his hand, he actually was a Orlando police officer that the extradition came over, and they actually, the warrant came and they arrested me there. And then the Chicago police came and got me and took me back to Chicago. And it wasn't easy because I had a child on the way myself from a previous relationship. And so this would be my firstborn. It was my son. That was crazy because I grew up without a father. Knowing who my real father was, I found out he grew up without a father. And now I'm gonna have a son who's gonna grow up without a father. And I didn't want that to happen. So that's pretty much how I ended up getting caught, because I tried to keep a relationship with him.
And you're listening to Carlos Colon, and my goodness, as he said about life in Humboldt Park in Chicago, from the 70s to the 90s, it was pretty drastic. What a tragic story thus far. When we come back, more of Carlos Colon's story here on Our American Stories.
So you're commuting to work again. Welcome back. Just take a deep breath and remember, you know how to do this. And the all-new Hyundai Kona and Kona Electric are there to help. Class-leading interior space means you can stretch out and relax. Advanced safety and intuitive tech like remote smart parking assist make parking less stressful. And complimentary BlueLink Plus allows you to set the climate controls remotely so the perfect temperature awaits. Learn more about the all-new Kona and your best commute ever at HyundaiUSA.com. Call 562-314-4603 for complete details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And we continue with Our American Stories and Carlos Colon's story. He had joined a Chicago gang at a young age, killed a man, and was on the run from the cops. Let's get back to Carlos with the rest of his story.
They sentenced me to do 20 years in prison. I had to do 20 years straight. You know, during that first 10 years, all I would think about is trying to occupy my time, try to make it up the hill and over the hill to get home. And, you know, we would make homemade wine and smuggle in drugs and smoke reefer or weed, however you want to call it. And I remember when I was 12, I want to make sure that you guys know this. When I was a kid, I got saved. I found Jesus. The problem was I would go home and Jesus was not preached to me because my home was domestic abuse, drug violence, and so we were poor. It wasn't like God was in the house. But no seed returns void. So the seeds were in me. I get to prison and, you know, they say blessings and curses come out the mouth. And I would always speak these curses, like, if I ever see this one person, I'm going to try to kill him. I'm going to try to do this and that. And one of them was the guy that actually killed a friend of mine, my buddy Fredo. And he ended up in the same prison as me. And like, he was in a big gang, but his gang turned on him. And now the numbers were in my favor. So I wanted this guy. And we got into a big fight, just me and him. And it got really bad where we ended up going to segregation, which is like a prison in the prison. And he actually witnessed to me, believe it or not. He actually shared the word with me. And, you know, I didn't take him as serious, but no seed returns void. So the seeds were planted again. So that's when I said, enough is enough. You know, I just wanted something different. You know, I talked about the void in my life. Well, you know, I went to prison with a void in my life. I figured it out. I realized it. It was Jesus. I was missing God in my life. Even though he was always there, I never willingly recommitted myself to him. I never willingly said, okay, Lord, I need you to go through this with me. You know, I needed him as my father. I was looking for a father, and he was always the one. So I remember making a prayer in segregation, and I started praying, and I asked God, listen, Lord, I know I'm in trouble. I know I'm going to go to a worse prison. I'm not trying to give you one of these prayers where if you get me out of this, I'll be good, because a lot of times we say that prayer and it's never the case. I just ask God to go with me and to, you know, watch over me and to surround me with believers and to make it where I can convince my wife to change her life, and I can have a home at home when I get home ready for me, a church waiting on me. And, you know, I wanted to totally change my life. I just wanted to turn away from who I was and become something new. And so that started the next 10 years, which were the best 10 years of my life in prison. I was able to not only recommit my life to the Lord, but, you know, God was preparing me to come home. I was raised with bitterness and rage and anger, and God was showing me the root of it. And God reminded me that if you want to be truly forgiven, and I've done some things, I was in jail for murder, that if you really want to be forgiven, you have to forgive. And so that's when I was saying, okay, Lord, I release that unto you. Show me how to forgive. And so no longer am I mad at the abusive man in my mother's life or my mom for the way she raised me. Even though times were tough, you know, she probably could have learned how to do things better. The past is the past. So I got to the point in my life where I said, okay, no more bitterness, no more anger, no more rage. Let's fill that with peace and joy and happiness. And I was hoping that he can make a way in my life, you know, to be forgiven by the families that I had took their son away, their brother away, their father away. You know, that was my prayer for the next 10 years. God was really spiritually getting me ready and motivating me for life outside of prison, a new life. There was this one man, I remember he was bold. His name was William Flores. And I would see him lead Bible studies, and, you know, I knew, okay, God sent me here to meet this man. And you're gonna always run into to people in your life at certain times in your life that were real influential. And this was a key moment, because this was the beginning. And it looked like I was gonna become a closet Christian. I seen his boldness, I needed that boldness. And I know what boldness was about, because in my life before Christ, I was always trying to be bold. So I seen this boldness, true boldness, by the way, no shame in speaking about Jesus. And I started attending his Bible studies whenever we would get recreation time. And I started picking his ear, and he would pray with me and teach me things of the Bible. And we would have prison Bible studies where people from outside of the prison would come in and freely spend time, voluntarily, by the way, fellowship with us, share the word with us. And we even had a Spanish preacher that would come and be bilingual and speak the word in English and Spanish, just so more people could attend his Bible studies. These are people who had different personalities, and they fed into my heart, into my life, where now I could pick their brains and figure out how to install these good qualities in my life, in my walk, when I come home. Now I'm back in Chicago and I work for my church. Not only do I work for my church, I'm in the same community that I did damage in. I remember going to Manny Mills in Glen Ellen. It's called Radical Timeout, and it's a time where everyone gets together and they pray radically. It's a place where they can pray and fellowship together and break bread together and hear the word together, worship together. And I remember going that, you know, I had to go there. It's a must. I went there and I've been going there every chance I get. And I gave my testimony there. I remember I had spoke about forgiveness and I wanted God to restore what the enemy had broken. And shortly after my testimony, I spoke to Neftali, who he's pretty much Manny Mills' right-hand man. And I found out that somebody was there giving their testimony who happened to be Nelson Vargas, the father of the man that I killed. And I spoke to Neftali about that, and I let him know, hey, you know, you just had a man here recently, and he just gave his testimony. I want you to know that that's the man whose son I killed. And Neftali went and through prayer, he spoke to Nelson and he set up a meeting where we met at Midwest Church with Pastor David, and him, his family met me and my wife, and he forgave me, you know. And this is something that was in my heart for the last 10 years in prison. Not only did he forgive me, but we have a relationship and he's wonderful, you know. And he tells me, now I'm your father, you know, now you're my son. He tells